Chapter 13. That morning, wandering about his plantation, more like a frightened soul than its creator and master, he dodged the white parasol bobbing up here and there like a buoy adrift on a sea of dark green plants. The crop promised to be magnificent, and the fashionable philosopher of the age took other than a merely scientific interest in the experiment. His investments were judicious, but he had always some little money lying by for experiments. After lunch, being left alone with Renaud, he talked a little of cultivation and such matters. Then suddenly, "By the way, is it true what my sister tells me, that your plantation boys have been disturbed by a ghost?" Renaud, who since the ladies had left the table was not keeping such a strict watch on himself, came out of his abstraction with a start and a stiff smile. "My foreman had some trouble with them during my absence. They funk working in a certain field on the slope of the hill." "A ghost here!" exclaimed the amused professor. "Then our whole conception of the psychology of ghosts must be revised. This island has been uninhabited, probably since the dawn of ages. How did a ghost come here? By air or water? And why did it leave its native haunts? Was it from misanthropy? Was he expelled from some community of spirits?" Renaud essayed to respond in the same tone. The words died on his lips. "Was it a man or a woman ghost?" the professor inquired. "I don't know." Renaud made an effort to appear at ease. "He had, he said, a couple of Tahitian amongst his boys, a ghost-ridden race. They had started the scare. They had probably brought their ghost with them." "Let us investigate the matter, Renaud," proposed the professor half in earnest. "He may make some interesting discoveries as to the state of primitive minds, at any rate." This was too much. Renaud jumped up and, leaving the room, went out and walked about in front of the house. He would allow no one to force his hand. Presently the professor joined him outside. He carried his parasol, but had neither his book nor his pipe with him. Amiably serious, he laid his hand on his dear young friend's arm. "We are all of us a little strung up," he said. "For my part, I have been like Sister Anne in the story. But I cannot see anything coming. Anything that would be the least good for anybody, I mean." Renaud had recovered sufficiently to murmur coldly his regret of this waste of time. For that was what, he supposed, the professor had in his mind. "Time," mused Professor Moorsom. "Don't know that time can be wasted. But I will tell you, my dear friend, what this is. It is an awful waste of life. I mean for all of us. Even for my sister, who has got a headache and is gone to lie down." He shook gently Renaud's arm. "Yes, for all of us. One may meditate on life endlessly, one may even have a poor opinion of it, but the fact remains that we have only one life to live. And it is short. Think of that, my young friend." He released Renaud's arm and stepped out of the shade, opening his parasol. It was clear that there was something more in his mind than mere anxiety about the date of his lectures for fashionable audiences. What did the man mean by his confounded platitudes? To Renaud, scared by lose in the morning, for he felt that nothing could be more fatal than to have his deception unveiled otherwise than by personal confession, this talk sounded like encouragement or a warning from that man who seemed to him to be very brazen and very subtle. It was like being bullied by the dead and cajoled by the living into a throw of dice for a supreme stake. Renaud went away to some distance from the house and threw himself down in the shade of a tree. He lay there perfectly still with his forehead resting on his folded arms, light-headed and thinking. It seemed to him that he must be on fire, then that he had fallen into a cool whirlpool, a smooth funnel of water swirling about with nauseating rapidity. And then, it must have been a reminiscence of his boyhood, he was walking on the dangerous thin ice of a river, unable to turn back. Suddenly it parted from shore to shore with a loud crack like the report of a gun. With one leap he found himself on his feet. All was peace, stillness, sunshine. He walked away from there slowly. Had he been a gambler, he would have perhaps been supported in a measure by the mere excitement. But he was not a gambler. He had always disdained that artificial manner of challenging the fates. The bungalow came into view, bright and pretty, and all about everything was peace, stillness, sunshine. While he was plodding towards it, he had a disagreeable sense of the dead man's company at his elbow. The ghost. He seemed to be everywhere but in his grave. Could one ever shake him off? He wondered. At that moment, Miss Morsom came out on the veranda, and at once, as if by a mystery of radiating waves, she roused a great tumult in his heart, shook earth and sky together, but he plodded on. Then, like a grave song note in the storm, her voice came to him ominously. Ah, Mr. Renaud. He came up and smiled, but she was very serious. Can't keep still any longer. Is there time to walk up this headland and back before dark? The shadows were lying lengthened on the ground. All was stillness and peace. Oh, said Renaud, feeling suddenly as steady as a rock. But I can show you a view from the central hill which your father has not seen. A view of reefs, and of broken water without end, and of great wheeling clouds of seabirds. She came down the veranda steps at once, and they moved off. You go first, he proposed, and I'll direct you. To the left. She was wearing a short Nankin skirt, a muslin blouse. He could see through the thin stuff the skin of her shoulders, of her arms. The noble delicacy of her neck caused him a sort of transport. He path begins where these three palms are. The only palms on the island. I see. She never turned her head. After a while she observed. His path looks as if it had been made recently. Quite recently, he ascended very low. They went on climbing steadily without exchanging another word. And when they stood on the top, she gazed a long time before her. The low evening mist veiled the further limit of the reefs. Above the enormous and melancholy confusion, as of a fleet of wrecked islands, the restless myriads of seabirds rolled and unrolled dark ribbons on the sky, gathered in clouds, soared and stooped like a play of shadows, for they were too far for them to hear their cries. Renaud broke the silence in low tones. They'll be settling for the night presently. She made no sound. Round them all was peace and declining sunshine. Nearby, the topmost pinnacle of Malata, resembling the top of a buried tower, rose a rock, weather-worn, gray, weary of watching the monotonous centuries of the Pacific. Renaud leaned his shoulders against it. Felicia Morsom faced him suddenly, her splendid black eyes full on his face, as though as he had made up her mind at last, to destroy his wits once and for all. Dazzled, he lowered his eyelids slowly. Mr. Renaud, there is something strange in all this. Tell me where he is? He answered deliberately. On the other side of this rock. I buried him there myself. She pressed her hands to her breast, struggled for her breath for a moment then. HHH. You buried him. What sort of man are you? You dared not tell. He is another of your victims? You dared not confess that evening. You must have killed him. What could he have done to you? You fastened on him some atrocious quarrel and... Her vengeful aspect, her poignant cries left him as unmoved as the weary rock against which he leaned. He only raised his eyelids to look at her, and lowered them slowly. Nothing more. It silenced her. And as if ashamed, she made a gesture with her hand, putting away from her that thought. He spoke, quietly ironic at first. Ah, the legendary Renaud of sensitive idiots, the ruthless adventurer, the ogre with a future. That was a parrot cry, Miss Morsom. I don't think that the greatest fool of them all ever dared hint such a stupid thing of me, that I killed men for nothing. No, I had noticed this man in a hotel. He had come from up country, I was told, and was doing nothing. I saw him sitting there lonely in a corner like a sick crow, and I went over one evening to talk to him. Just on impulse. He wasn't impressive. He was pitiful. My worst enemy could have told you he wasn't good enough to be one of Renauer's victims. It didn't take me long to judge that he was drugging himself. Not drinking. Drugs. Ah. It's now that you are trying to murder him, she cried. Really? Always the Renauer of shopkeeper's legend. Listen. I would never have been jealous of him. And yet I am jealous of the air you breathe, of the soil you tread on, of the world that sees you moving free, not mine. But never mind. I rather liked him. For a certain reason I proposed he should come to be my assistant here. He said he believed this would save him. It did not save him from death. It came to him as it were from nothing, just a fall. A mere slip and tumble of 10 feet into a ravine. But it seems he had been hurt before upcountry by a horse. He ailed and ailed. No, he was not a steel-tipped man. And his poor soul seemed to have been damaged too. It gave way very soon. This is tragic. Felicia Mursum whispered with feeling. Renauer's lips twitched, but his level voice continued mercilessly. That's the story. He rallied a little one night, and said he wanted to tell me something. I, being a gentleman, he said, he could confide in me. I told him that he was mistaken. That there was a good deal of a plebeian in me that he couldn't know. He seemed disappointed. He muttered something about his innocence, and something that sounded like a curse on some woman, then turned to the wall, and just grew cold. On a woman, cried Miss Mursum indignantly. Hat woman? I wonder, said Renauer, raising his eyes and noting the crimson of her earlobes against the live whiteness of her complexion, the somber, as if secret, night splendor of her eyes under the writhing flames of her hair. Oh, woman who wouldn't believe in that poor innocence of his. Yes. You probably. And now you will not believe in me, not even in me who must in truth be what I am even to death. No. You won't. And yet, Felicia, a woman like you and a man like me do not often come together on this earth. The flame of her glorious head scorched his face. He flung his hat far away, and his suddenly lowered eyelids brought out startlingly his resemblance to antique bronze. The profile of Pallas, still, austere, bowed a little in the shadow of the rock. H. If you could only understand the truth that is in me, he added. She waited, as if too astounded to speak, till he looked up again, and then with unnatural force, as if defending herself from some unspoken aspersion, it's I who stand for truth here. Believe in you. In you, who by a heartless falsehood and nothing else, do you hear? Have brought me here, deceived, cheated, as in some abominable farce. She sat down on a boulder, rested her chin in her hands, in the pose of simple grief mourning for herself. It only wanted this. Why? Oh! Why is it that ugliness, ridicule, and baseness must fall across my path? On that height, alone with the sky, they spoke to each other, as if the earth had fallen away from under their feet. Are you grieving for your dignity? He was a mediocre soul, and could have given you, but an unworthy existence. She did not even smile at those words, but, superb, as if lifting a corner of the veil, she turned on him slowly. And do you imagine I would have devoted myself to him for such a purpose? Don't you know that reparation was due to him from me? A sacred debt, a fine duty. To redeem him would not have been in my power, I know it. But he was blameless, and it was for me to come forward. Don't you see that in the eyes of the world nothing could have rehabilitated him so completely as his marriage with me? No word of evil could be whispered of him, after I had given him my hand. As to giving myself up to anything less than the shaping of a man's destiny, if I thought I could do it, I would abhor myself. She spoke with authority in her deep, fascinating, unemotional voice. Renauer meditated, gloomy, as if over some sinister riddle of a beautiful sphinx met on the wild road of his life. Yes. Your father was right. You are one of these aristocrats. She drew herself up haughtily. What do you say? My father, I am an aristocrat. Oh. I don't mean that you are like the men and women of the time of armors, castles, and great deeds. Oh, no. They stood on the naked soil, had traditions to be faithful to, had their feet on this earth of passions and death which is not a hothouse. They would have been too plebeian for you, since they had to lead, to suffer with, to understand the commonest humanity. No, you are merely of the topmost layer, disdainful and superior, the mere pure froth and bubble on the inscrutable depths which someday will toss you out of existence. But you are you. You are you. You are the eternal love itself only, O divinity, it isn't your body, it is your soul, that is made of foam. She listened as if in a dream. He had succeeded so well in his effort to drive back the flood of his passion, that his life itself seemed to run with it out of his body. At that moment he felt as one dead speaking. But the headlong wave returning with tenfold force, flung him on her suddenly, with open arms and blazing eyes. She found herself like a feather in his grasp, helpless, unable to struggle, with her feet off the ground. But this contact with her, maddening like too much felicity, destroyed its own end. Fire ran through his veins, turned his passion to ashes, burned him out, and left him empty, without force, almost without desire. He let her go, before she could cry out. And she was so used to the forms of repression enveloping, softening the crude impulses of old humanity, that she no longer believed in their existence, as if it were an exploded legend. She did not recognize what had happened to her. She came safe out of his arms, without a struggle, not even having felt afraid. "What's the meaning of this?" she said, outraged but calm in a scornful way. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.